From New Freedom to Scottsdale, Counterport to Erie, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, it is July and it is hot. But are we really experiencing our hottest days ever? Dr. Mark Hendrickson from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College is here with the answer. Taking aim at reducing the suicide rate among veterans, the USAA has launched Face the Fight, with the goal of cutting that rate in half by 2030. Joe Geiger has Amish Vakaria of USAA in the Community Benefit Spotlight. And thousands of Pennsylvanians work in the gig economy for Uber, DoorDash, and similar jobs. But lawmakers are taking aim at their independent contractor status. Emily Green from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania has this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Mark Hendrickson in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Pennsylvania's state budget is overdue and remains in stalemate, with funding for a school choice program for students in underperforming school districts the key stumbling block. The issue took center stage again this past week at a Senate Education Committee hearing in Reading, where parents of those students pleaded for immediate action to give them more education options. Opponents argued for spending even more money on public schools, but State Senator David Argle pointed out, quote, "The results have not been what any of us had hoped." Senator Anthony Williams, a Philadelphia Democrat, concurred that billions have been spent on public schools, quote, "with no return on academic achievement or success." The disagreement on how to proceed continues to push a budget agreement out of reach. On a related note, Republican lawmakers have decided not to appeal a Commonwealth Court ruling that found Pennsylvania's system of funding public education to be unconstitutional. While no clear pathway has emerged to fixing the system, the court ruling did find that reform does not need to be purely financial and that options are, quote, virtually limitless. The Pennsylvania House of Representatives has once again fallen into a 101-101 tie with the resignation last week of State Representative Sarah Inamorato of Allegheny County. She is running for county executive and plans to focus her efforts on winning that office. As a result, a special election will be held on September 19th to select a replacement. The seat is heavily Democratic and likely to return the party to its one-seat majority, but the resignation is one more complication in resolving the state budget, as Democrats are unlikely to call the chamber back into session until the new representatives from the 21st District is seated. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. A July heat wave has gripped some parts of the southeastern United States, prompting climate change alarmists to proclaim that we are experiencing our hottest days ever. Dr. Mark Hendrickson is a fellow for economic and social policy with the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College. He recently took a look at that claim and at the actual climate data. He's here to talk about it. Mark, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Mark, anytime you talk about climate change and you disagree with the prevailing view of the left, they call you a denier. Are you denying that there's climate change?
On the contrary, Loman, there is always climate change. It's a constant throughout the billions of years of Earth's history. It can't be stopped. It's always going to happen. The policy question is what kind of impact humans are having on climate change, and that's an entirely different issue.
This whole debate has been revved up again recently because of the fact that it's hot outside. A lot of us would point out it's July, so that sort of normally happens, but some parts of the country, Mark, have been experiencing record heat, and they're claiming that we've seen the hottest days ever. Is that claim accurate?
No, we have data going back about 150 years in our country's history measuring temperatures. The 1930s, for example, were a lot hotter than today. You notice when they come out with one of these scare stories about the hottest ever, that you'll find somewhere in the story, at least if they're being honest, well, according to our data, it goes back to 1979 or something like that. So, you know, you're talking about a 44-year period. Sure, there are going to be places that have record highs during a 44-year period. That's no big deal. But it was hotter in the 30s. There were some times before that when it was hotter. Earlier eras in human history, such as the medieval warm period, the Roman period, the Minoan period, they were all warmer than today. And then if you want to go to paleoclimatology stuff, well, gosh, in the previous interglacial period, you know, we're in between ice ages right now here on Earth. And so the previous one was warmer than today. So to say it's the hottest ever is a gross exaggeration.
We have this El Nino situation out in the ocean at the moment, Mark. Is that something that is causing the warmer than average temperatures in parts of the country?
Yeah, we have found there's a high correlation between the phenomenon called El Nino, which is a warming in the Pacific, and the scientists haven't figured out what causes that. If you take elementary physics, you understand that the tendency of heat is to disperse. So heat theoretically should disperse across the Earth's atmosphere. Why does it get hot there? It's not that the Earth's rotation has stopped and the sun is trained on that spot like a magnifying glass, making it hotter. And there's no way that heat can gather itself around that the central Pacific Ocean. So my theory, and of course I'm not a scientist, I'm an economist, but to me the only possible explanation is there's something going down on the floor of the ocean. You know, we're constantly having tectonic shifts. There's magma that boils up from the Earth's core, and of course that's tremendously hot stuff, so that probably heats the water from down there. My theory is that there's something going on at the submarine level, below the surface of the ocean, that's causing this, but it's definitely not carbon dioxide.
Let's drill down a little bit further on this issue of carbon dioxide and man-made causes of climate change here, Mark. If you look at earlier periods that were warmer than we are now, that would be before man started putting carbon dioxide out into the atmosphere. So what are the causes of this, or is this just something that naturally happens?
I just read a study that was published in Earth's Future Journal. It's a follow-up study. A scientist by the name of W. Jackson Davis, first in 2017 and now this year, he studied the paleoclimatology data. And he found that for 97.44% of the last 425 million years, there's either a negative correlation between carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and Earth's temperatures, or no correlation at all. In other words, it's flukish. Every now and then, for like 2% of the time, they seem to the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere and earthly temperatures seem to kind of coincide and run together. But for over 97% of Earth's history, that has not been the case.
We are talking with Dr. Mark Hendrickson. He is a fellow for economic and social policy at the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College. And Mark, let's talk a bit about government reporting and all the academic reporting that gets done on climate change.
Cases in recent years where there have been record lows, and those don't get reported or trumped up the way the record highs do, and that's because there's a political agenda at play. Let me read you something from President Eisenhower's farewell address. You know, that's the one where everybody says, oh, yeah, he warned about the military-industrial complex. He also said this. He said, we got to watch out for the prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment project allocations and the power of money. And then he said there's a danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific technological elite. And so what you have here is billions of dollars getting spent every year by the government supporting this whole climate change hysteria industry. And the goal, and I'm not just saying this, I've got quotes filed away by some of the leading proponents of climate alarmism who come right out and say, you know, this really isn't about the environment, it's about transforming the economy. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to panic people and say, hey, human activity is what's causing this. And it's not. You've got other influences, including a little something called the sun and changes in cloud cover and changes in humidity and so on and so forth. And the scientific data show that basically the way carbon dioxide does act as an absorber of heat, that it's already saturated, which is a way of saying that even if carbon dioxide in the atmosphere were to double now, it would have minimal effect on insulation because the effect is already pretty much consummated. So I've been asked, like you asked if I was a denier, I've also been asked by interviewers, hey, have you ever received money from an oil company? Because, you know, according to this ideology, which is almost a theology, it's like the evil in the world is fossil fuels and oil companies. And for the record, no, I've never received a payment from an oil company. But I think the fair question, Loman, is to say to anybody who is an alarmist scientist, say, have you received government grants? Because there are all sorts of independent scientists who say that this climate change alarmism is totally unscientific, that it's a violation of the scientific method, that it's a disgrace. The 2022 winner of the Nobel Prize in Physics, John Clauser, he just recently came out and said, you know, this climate change stuff is nonsense in terms of it being a danger. It's happening, but we're not in control of it. And he's already being shut down. You know, well, we can't let this guy speak. So, I mean, we really have to be seeing this whole issue of climate change as a political power play by an elite that just wants to use it as an excuse to grab more power so that they can play socialist central planner and tell us, you know, what we have to do with our economy.
In past warming periods here, Mark, what actually happened on the planet? Were there the dire consequences that climate change alarmists talk about today? Or were there actually parts of the Earth that benefited from the warmer climate?
Well, if you talk about human civilization, it just seems to flourish when the periods of climate are warmer than colder. And that stands to reason because when it's colder, you have more famines, you have, you know, more difficulty with agriculture. And so I referenced earlier the Minoan period, the Roman period, the medieval warm period. Those were all boom periods for civilization. So warm is good for people. And let me share this amazing statistic that the alarmists never point out, and that is that there has been a 99% decline in climate-related deaths over the last century. I mean, in the battle of humans against climate, and we're always going to have it, Mother Nature does nasty stuff, and it can have lethal effects. But we're winning that war. We have found ways to avoid the worst outcomes of climate events, or which really in the short term should be called weather events. So, I mean, there's absolutely nothing to panic about here.
It's very interesting that you raise the difference between climate and weather, because weather changes quite frequently. Climate changes over time. You have a great chart in your article that explains all of this. It shows that we're actually in one of the cool periods of time. And all of that is on your website. And we are talking with Mark Hendrickson. Mark is a fellow for economic and social policy, that at the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College. Mark, tell us a bit about the Institute and also give us that website where folks can read your article and also see the chart that I just referenced.
Okay, well, I'll give the website first so I don't forget that. It's faithandfreedom.com. That's nice and simple, faithandfreedom.com. And it's a think tank associated with Grove City College, which is in Grove City, Pennsylvania, the western part of the state. And it's one of the few colleges in the country that does not accept federal money. We're totally independent. And we are also Christian-oriented and traditional values. And so when you go to this website, you can read articles by different scholars about family and social policy, as well as economics. So for the conservatives in your audience, and I'm sure there are many of them, I think they will find this a very helpful website.
Dr. Mark Hendrickson from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College. Mark, as always, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Loman.
Cutting the suicide rate among U.S. veterans in half by 2030 is the goal of Face the Fight, a new project launched by USAA and its partners. In the Community Benefit Spotlight, Joe Geiger has part two of a two-part interview with Amish Vakharia of USAA. Joe?
This is Joe Geiger on the Lincoln Radio program. We have a guest coming back, Amish Vakharia, who is an executive in the USAA, and they're launching a program, Face the Fight, $40 million program to address veteran suicide. Amish, share with the listeners, if you will, what Face the Fight program looks like.
Joe, I'm glad to be here, be back with you. You know, Face the Fight It's a coalition of corporations, foundations, nonprofit, and veteran-focused organizations who are coming together to both raise awareness and support for veteran suicide prevention. We've set an aspiration to cut the veteran suicide rate in half by 2030. We've worked with a team of experts, including the UT Health Science Center here in San Antonio, the Veterans Administration, the Department of Defense, RAND Corporation, and other nonprofit alliances to design both the philanthropic strategy and to identify the outcomes part of this. Initial grants from this have already been made to 6 nonprofit organizations, including Headstrong Project, the Ohio State University Foundation, UT Health Science Center in San Antonio, Stop Soldier Suicide, Cohen Veterans Network, and the University of Washington Foundation. The initial focus is on supporting nonprofit programs with specific areas around suicide prevention and training programs, clinical fellowships to strengthen the pipeline of qualified clinicians, and distribution of tools to veteran service organizations, the legal community, and other entities who work with veterans.
I assume that there'll be a different approach in that. If you just call it suicide prevention, there may not be a willingness for someone to say, I'm really toying with the idea of killing myself. There are a lot of programs out there that work with the mental health of the organization, and you're going to collaborate with those. And I know from running a foundation for the last 10 years that there's a big hunger for helping veterans, and there's a big hunger for organizations that have different ways of doing it. You see equine programs, you see canine programs, you see support groups. As you look at the organizations who may request funding from you, how do they need to position themselves to get a favorable response?
You're absolutely right in that no one individual organization can address this alone. And so our goal here is, as you said, aspirational and intended to be a galvanizing force to inspire and mobilize others, given how many different groups are out there already attempting to help in some meaningful way. We've actually partnered with the Elizabeth Dole Foundation, which is a leading nonprofit organization empowering, supporting, and honoring 5.5 million military caregivers. And so to your question around those wanting to join the coalition, again, would ask, they can learn more about how to do so by visiting wefacethefight.org. And that's how folks can see the different ways in which they can get connected, whether that's through philanthropic giving, whether that's through services, whether that's through outreach and connectivity. There definitely is a whole host of ways that folks can get involved.
So in the nonprofit community, we get very protective of our programs. And if a nonprofit organization like Bravehearts organization it's in Illinois, it's an equine therapy program. How do you negotiate the comfort zone for that nonprofit? Are they going to need to give up some ownership of how they do things, or are you going to just provide money to help with that? Will you connect nonprofit organizations with each other when you see like and similar activities going?
I think it's a little bit of all of the above. So on the first side of the question of how can we make it easier for individuals and or organizations who want to give, we've established a dedicated donor advice fund. And what that does is for those who want to give but don't know which organizations or how to go about that and do their own research, this donor advice fund will give benefit from the research, the targeted research that USAA and the USAA Foundation have done, and will continue to ensure every dollar counts. So there's an identification and vetting process that we will go through on part of this, and 100% of contributions will be dedicated to Face the Fight grants. On the other side of the question of how are we going to select organizations to receive the grants, that's where we're connecting to the evidence-based programs to be able to see that the money is being directed where we see the greatest impact in terms of lives saved. And that, through here, the coalition, we've developed this dynamic modeling process, which is used often in public health programs, to help guide that so that the money is going to those organizations that where we see the greatest amount of impact to this ultimate objective of cutting the veteran suicide rate in half.
This is Joe Geiger on the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest is Amish Vakharia with USAA. What would you say to someone sitting out there saying it's you're just another program throwing money at a problem? How can you help them get past that?
This is a problem we can't ignore. USAA has been founded by the military and has served the military proudly for 101 years. And this is the number one topic our members and military families who aren't members are saying that they want to see us help address because of those astounding rates with veterans' suicide being 1.5 times out of the general population. Given 14 million military families we serve and the knowledge we've gained over 101 years in serving them, we think we have a lot to bring to the table and are excited about building this coalition to amplify and complement those existing efforts that are there.
How else can the citizen who was not part of the military help with the goal and the program that you're launching?
Giving through monetary contribution is one way. And you mentioned we have set up a donor advised fund for that, but there's so many other ways. And I think the easiest way for folks to learn more on the effort, how to help or how to join the fight, I'd recommend folks can go visit wefacethefight.org to learn more and get connected.
This is Joe Geiger in the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest today for interview number two is Amish Vakharia. He's the Executive Vice President and Chief Strategy and Brand Manager at USAA.
Joe, I appreciate the time and look forward to circling back and sharing the progress with you.
Back to you, Lohman.
Lawmakers at both the federal and state levels are looking to extend their control over the independent contractor or gig economy. We get details from Emily Green of Americans for Prosperity on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
Competition is a word that has deep roots in free market ideology, but has been twisted and manipulated by many on the left to sell a top-down, Washington-centric approach to public policy, which, ironically, does nothing to spark competitiveness. Take President Biden's Competition Council, which the administration defines as an executive order to, quote, promote competition in the American economy. Among the names appointed to the task force are POTUS-nominated cabinet appointees, with Acting Secretary of Labor Julie Hsu at the top of the list of voices. Hsu has been no stranger to headlines over the past few months, as her record of anti-competitive labor policies are being brought to the forefront of national news ahead of Senator Schumer's attempt to confirm Hsu as Secretary of Labor, albeit unsuccessfully, as even the Democratic caucus does not have the votes to do so. Julie Hsu's history of anti-competitive, pro-control policy is best summed up by her support and enforcement of Assembly Bill 5 during her tenure as California's Secretary of Labor and Workforce Development from 2019 to 2021. This legislation, known colloquially as AB 5, threatens the livelihoods of millions of Californians by instituting a convoluted and unworkable, quote, ABC test to determine whether a worker is an independent contractor or a traditional employee. Ultimately, this legislation upended thousands of independent contracting jobs due to the burdensome regulations that followed the results of the three-pronged ABC test. Californians who relied on gig work, such as Uber, Grubhub, and other flexible work opportunities, were left without the ability to set their own schedules or make a living in a way that makes sense for themselves and their families. This was a big problem for California, and Hsu's rise to the national political stage serves as a massive problem for the over 5 million reported gig workers across the country. According to a recent paper published by the University of Chicago, over 5 million employees filed earnings through platform-based independent contracting and gig work. In fact, Uber reported a record high number of employees at the end of 2022, citing 5.4 million employees through their flagship rideshare company and Uber Eats, their platform for gig-based food delivery. Given these numbers, a federal approach to California's AB 5 would be detrimental for millions of Americans who rely on flexible work to care for their dependents and make an honest living. There is one demographic of American worker that is most impacted by an ABC-style classification test, the American mother. According to DoorDash, a food delivery service that allows for flexible scheduling, 60% of the company's female employees report that they are parents or caregivers, and the flexibility of the role allows them to care for their dependents or loved ones. In fact, 73% of the company's female employees shared that they took up DoorDash to, quote, make up for lost income. American mothers need flexible income opportunities, and the AB5 style approach to worker misclassification strips them of their ability to seek out these employment options. Bidenomics, or President Joe Biden's top-down approach to, quote, improve the country's economic outlook, includes the PRO Act, the administration's efforts to replicate AB5 nationwide. Amongst many things, it would also prevent right-to-work legislation in many states, which allows employees to opt out of unions in the workplace. In states where right-to-work legislation exists, the economy booms. Right-to-work allows for higher wages and higher earnings for employees by removing the stifling regulations that come with union work. Though Pennsylvania is not a right-to-work state, the union influence recently inspired Harrisburg Democrats to introduce House Bill 950, which was an attempt by the House to pass a constitutional amendment that would forever prevent Pennsylvania from becoming a right-to-work state, and forever prevent Pennsylvania's economy from competing with states such as Florida, North Carolina, and West Virginia. Though the Commonwealth's outlook can seem bleak, Americans for Prosperity thanked the minority chairman of the House Labor and Industry Committee, Representative Ryan McKenzie, for standing up for workers and opposing House Bill 950. In a quote, the representative from Lehigh County shared, "We want to make sure that individuals have the right to join or not join a union. That is their personal choice, and it is up to them. We want to make sure that when they get into those jobs, they aren't facing unnecessary burdens or licensing requirements." Check out prosperityispossible.com, sign your name to our growing list of advocates from every corner of the state, and stay in touch to hold your members accountable to you, the taxpayer. That's prosperityispossible.com. Send an email directly to your members inbox. Help us fight to make Pennsylvania a more competitive state for all.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 28 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WKMC-AM and WBRX-FM in Altoona, WPDC-AM in Elizabethtown, and WVMM-FM in Grantham, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the cost of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. ¶¶